time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for November 24th, 2018. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving holiday and that you even had a chance to go for a ride. We did not. From what everyone said, it's been the coldest Thanksgiving in history on the East Coast. So we just hunkered down, watched a little bit of the Macy's Day Parade, and spent an evening with friends. All in all, a great day. Now it's the countdown to the big one, that gift-giving frenzy time of year, and tonight we'll talk a bit about stocking stuffers with Kristen Wentworth from Planet Bike. We'll talk about lights and bells and some cold weather gear. And while the company itself is pretty small, it does some really big things when it comes to charity. We'll discuss that too. After our chat with Kristen, we'll talk about one of the most iconic and enduring events on the East Coast, the assault on Mount Mitchell. Ride director Katie Jordan joins me to give us some history on the ride, why you cannot ride down the mountain after you've climbed it, and what alternative is available if you aren't up for the 7,500-plus elevation of the mountain and the 102 miles it takes to get to the top. Finally, I catch up with Marty Jemison. I've been following Marty's beautiful photographs from all over the globe over the past few months and wanted to know more about his company, Jemison Cycling Tours. Marty's long history with cycling, including racing in Europe after college, led to his desire to offer tours that are tailored around the clients who book them. But before we move on to the show, I'd like to correct something from last week. The CEO of Zwift, Eric Min, was supposed to be on the show this week. Unfortunately, he has declined the interview. So let's head on over to Wisconsin and talk with Kristen Wentworth from Planet Bike about some of the great ideas for this year's gift-giving season. Hi, Kristen. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So our mutual friend, actually, I guess he's in Planet Bike's company, Jay Firm, hooked us up so that we could talk about some accessories for cycling. And there are a couple of categories that I think might make great gifts for the holidays. What you got on your, I know you made a list for me.
Sure.
So
sure.
What do you have? What's your first item?
Sure. How about we start with lights? It's light season, definitely, right now with the shorter days. So, and every cyclist can always use more lights. It seems like you can never have too many. We offer a nice little USB rechargeable set called the Spock USB set. And they come with rubber straps, so you can put them virtually anywhere. There's a front light and a tail light. Add them on really quick to a handlebar or a helmet or anywhere on the frame. And they give you some nice visibility just anywhere you need it. So that's a really great little stocking stuffer set.
And they're rechargeable?
They are, yes. Yep. So they recharge quick. And the battery life will last probably about 5 hours, 5 to 10 hours on flash. And then they also have a steady and then a pulse where they slowly fade up and down, which is kind of a nice option if you're on like a multi-use path and you don't want to be flashing your oncoming cyclists and pedestrians.
Yeah, that is nice. I like that idea. I don't know that I've seen them do up and down like that. Interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
And another sort of unique one is our bottle blinky. And what this is it is amber side lighting that gets mounted. It has kind of a plastic plate that gets mounted to the water bottle mounts on the bicycle frame. And there are three LEDs on each side that will either be steady, flash, or again, have that slow fade up and down to give you some side visibility. So it's sort of a unique option to just light you up on the side.
Interesting. So it's an amber light.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you don't need the water bottle cage there. It can get mounted right to those mounts. So if you don't have a water bottle cage there, it's not necessary.
Sounds like a cool little stocking stuffer. What else you got?
bells are another fun category. We make a wide variety of them. There's a nice little flexi bell that just has a rubber strap, so you can just mount it wherever you need it to go. We offer some that mount the clincher bells that'll mount to your brake cable right on the bike. And then there's kind of a nice classic, courtesy bell classic, which is a little bit larger and just a real classic design and a nice deep tone to it. So,
you know, I'm a big believer in bells, that when you're on a trail and you pass somebody, everybody says on your left. Well, some people can't hear that because you aren't talking loud enough, or they might even have headphones on, but almost everybody can sort of decipher the sound of a bell. And it's, we always have a bell on our bike. Well, that's really, really interesting. So let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Kristen Wentworth. She's with Planet Bike. We're talking about gifts for the holidays, little gifts, stocking stuffers maybe, things that every cyclist can use. My next category, because I want to pipe up here, is about the cold. I have so much trouble with my fingers and toes. And I know you have some really cool gloves for wimps like me. So tell us about your, is it the Aquilo and the Borealis?
Yes. Yep, the Aquilo is kind of our fall, more of our fall season. And so both of these gloves that you've mentioned are what we call our split lobster. And so what that means is that your pinky and your ring finger are off together in one area. And then your middle finger and your index finger are separate, and as is your thumb. So that kind of gives you those three fingers, more dexterity to shift and to break. But it keeps, you know, those smaller, that pinky next to the ring finger to help keep it warm. The Aquilo has a windproof outer cover, but there's not a ton of insulation to it. But I find it great for like upper 40s, low 50s, or, you know, in the 50s is good. And then the Borealis has a lot more insulation to it, and it actually has a fleece liner glove as well. So you can kind of use it all together, the fleece liner and the outer glove, when it's really cold, or just take the fleece liner off and just use that outer when it's in like the 30s. So that one is great. I find I can wear that one down into the mid-20s without really having cold hands.
So you can actually remove the liner from the Borealis glove?
Yeah, it comes with a totally separate fleece liner glove, and then the outer, and the fleece liner glove is all digits are individual, so it's a true glove. And then the outer is that split lobster to just keep the pinky and ring finger a little bit warmer.
That's a design that it might work for me. That sounds really, really cool. How about feet? So I like to wear my sandals with wool socks, but I really, because I can't find shoes that are really, really comfortable. But what about shoe and foot covers?
Yeah, I mean, we have three different offerings. So we start with just a toe cover that is a windproof portion that gets pulled around. It extends almost all the way up to the top of the foot. And then there's also a strap that goes around back to help keep it secure. But I find that's really great, you know, in the 40s, below 40 degrees. I like something with either the neoprene Comet covers that we offer, or for colder, we have what we call the Blitzen, and that's windproof with a little bit of fleece lining at the upper as well. And those will keep your feet warm down into the 30s, definitely.
So do you think that those shoe covers, will they run true to size? Do they run a little small, big? What would you recommend when you're looking at sizing?
Yeah, definitely size up. You're going to want to add. So they're kind of designed for a true cycling shoe that has a clip on the bottom. If your shoe has some sole to it, you're going to want to definitely go up a little bit larger than you think you might need to. So we actually make the Blitzen in up to triple XL, kind of for that reason, because we've certainly found that some people want to wear just a regular old boot that's not cycling specific, but still want to be able to put a cover over it. So we make them really large as a result.
Yeah, for Sasquatch. I get it. So, you know, sometimes you want to do something that just kind of makes your bike look good. You know, just, you don't want to completely overhaul it. You don't want to send it out for repaint. And one of the cool things that I always thought, and we've always recommended to clients, is change your handlebar tape, right? So you actually have a tape that I've never seen before, and it's reflective, a tachyon tape with reflective stuff on it. How does that work?
Yeah. So the tachyon tape is kind of a rubbery padded tape that we make. It's got almost like a diamond shape to it, so it feels really nice on your hands. And then the reflective version has little tiny cutouts. There's like four little rows, and they're pretty stealthy. You know, they don't really look like anything when it's daytime, but if you shine a light on them in the dark, they really light up. So it's a, you know, the tape looks really sharp even without those reflective accents during the day, but then at night it just kind of adds a little bit when you're out there in traffic.
Cool. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Kristen Wentworth. She's with Planet Bike. They make so many different accessories for bicycling, from fenders and a lot of things that we probably won't be able to cover today. But one of the things I want to cover is, number one, your website. So I went out to it, and you actually do something I don't always see, which is you give people an opportunity to buy online, but you have a button next to every product that says, buy it locally or find it locally. And so I just typed in my zip code, and like within 2 seconds, every bike shop in the area that carried Planet Bike products came up for me. What would you say the split is between people actually ordering online, and I know you process those online orders because we talked about that before we went on the air, and people then looking at that local button and going to a bike shop?
Sure. I mean, we really want folks to buy from shops. I mean, we're big believers in the value of local bike shops. My parents own a bike shop. We've all, you know, worked in shops. So they're our partners, and we want folks to purchase there. So we certainly are going to offer things online and let people see all of our options and the specs on things. But we really want people to buy in there. And we honestly, we don't do a ton of sales through our site directly. We really try to push people onto shops when it's possible. And that's why we have that buy local option on our website.
Yay. Having also owned a bike shop for many, many years. The last thing I want to talk about is a little more serious, and that is Planet Bike takes advocacy very seriously. You actually have a full-time person, Jay Firm, who works on advocacy. Give us a brief overview of the kinds of things Planet Bike does for both domestic and international communities, because you've really gotten involved heavily for such a small company.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely been one of the guiding principles since our founding in 1996, and we've given away at this point $2.4 million over the years. You know, currently we're working with groups like the League of American Bicyclists. We're really into NICA right now, which is the national kind of high school mountain bike league.
Right.
So we've been helping with get their GRIT program, which is Girls Riding Together, helping with that program. More locally here in Madison, there's a free bikes for kids chapter, which that program started in Minneapolis, Madison. This is now going to be their third year of doing it. And they give 1,000 bikes away in the springtime to kids in the area, which it's an awesome program. So that's something that we've really kind of upped our involvement in. The Bike Fed of Wisconsin. So we try to do stuff locally as well as nationally. We don't do a lot internationally. And kind of our focus is really families, women, people of color. We're just kind of trying to reach those groups right now.
Well, I think it's commendable. And this time of year, when we're talking Thanksgiving and the holidays, it's good to know of a company that's doing that kind of thing. Well, Kristen, thank you so much for taking time. I know you guys are getting ready for the holidays as we are. I've been talking with Kristen Wentworth from Planet Bike with some holiday gift ideas. I hope you and your family have a great holiday, and Planet Bike family has a great holiday. Thanks for talking with me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Diane.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Kristen Wentworth joined me from her office at Planet Bike. If you are interested in any of the products we discussed, you can see them online at planetbike.com. Each product will offer you the opportunity to find a local IBD, too. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk with Katie Jordan from The Assaults. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. My next guest became the ride director of the assaults on Mount Mitchell and Marion 5 years ago. The iconic event will be 44 years old when it steps off on May 20th, 2019. Hi, Katie. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week and happy holidays.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I have known about the assault on Mount Mitchell for almost as long as I can remember being in the bike business. It's an iconic event, and now we get to talk about it, and I'm really, really excited about it. Tell us a little bit about the history, and then we'll dive into the nuts and bolts of the event itself.
Sure. It is an iconic, you know, it's just one of those events that's been around for a very long time. We're celebrating our 44th year this year, and one of the things I want to do is try and do some research to find out what other rides have actually been going on for that long, because 44 years for any event is a really long time. So definitely an iconic event. History-wise, in 1975, John Bryan, who was a member of the cycling club here in Spartanburg, South Carolina, called the Freewheelers, he had this great idea to leave Spartanburg, South Carolina, and travel a route through five different counties onto the Blue Ridge Parkway, and then the final ascent up to the Mount Mitchell State Park, which is the highest point east of the Mississippi. He thought that that would be enjoyable on a bike. So he set out to do this. He had a couple of club members with him that year. And from what I've heard, nobody finished that year, that they were not able to make the full climb. They didn't reach the end of the park, the summit. So I think what it did was it, you know, whetted their whistle to try and kind of get some more people involved to try and do it the next year. And it just each year thereafter, more and more people came out to join and do this ride in May. I think it's always been in May, and try and, you know, assault that last 28 miles of the Blue Ridge Parkway and the final ascent to the state park. So that's really, it really just, you know, it was just a group of guys that just wanted to go out and ride their bikes, and that's what they did.
Well, it's interesting. There are two other rides that are long lasting that I think started out very similarly. One is the tour of the Scioto River Valley, known as Tazrov here in Ohio. And then there's, okay. And then there's Ragbri. Of course, Ragbri is a week long party, so that's kind of a different thing. You're the ride director now for this one. How did that happen? How did you become ride director for these assaults? And I know we're going to talk about the fact is there are two different events.
Sure. Well, I am not a cyclist. I am an event planner. So my background is all about logistics, planning large scale events. I work for a company out of Greenville. They're an integrated marketing and event planning company. So I'm not a cyclist, but I'm really good on the logistics side. And while we need the cyclists, obviously, to have the assault on Mount Mitchell, you've got to have the logistics because, like I said, you're going 102 miles through five different counties. You're in some very unfamiliar terrain, I guess. You're kind of in the backwoods for a very long time, so safety becomes an issue, having good police coverage. And then also the logistics of once you end and having to hand over your bike and then get you off of a mountaintop. You know, you're talking about a very tiny summit of a mountain, national park or a state park, that we've got all these people ending up on, that we've got to transport them safely out of there on these large buses as well as their bikes. So they needed someone from a logistics standpoint that could kind of manage the ride, looking at it through that lens. And so that's where they brought us on board about 5 years ago. And we've been directing for the past 5 years.
So it's really interesting that people don't know the work that goes in underneath. You know, they show up, they get their number, they get their packet, they get on their bikes and they ride. And then suddenly rest stops show up and markings show up and you've got permits and you've got insurance and you've got all this stuff. And it's like, it's magic, only it takes a lot of work. And I totally get it. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Katie Jordan. She is one, I assume, the ride director for the assaults, and that's plural. And one is on Mount Mitchell, which is the one that I knew about. I did not know there was a second assault. Tell us about the assault on Marion.
So it's the assault on Marion. The 102 miles to get to Mitchell is not for everyone. It's hard, and you have to train. And so what they did in 1993 the Assault on Mount Mitchell would sell out every single year. Rides like this were not as popular, so you didn't have as many to choose from. So the Assault on Mount Mitchell would typically sell out every year by, I think, March in advance of May. And so they opened up the Assault on Marion, which is a shorter ride. It takes you from Spartanburg to rest stop number 5, which is at the Tom Johnson Campground in Marion, North Carolina. And it's about 73 miles. It's not an easy ride. It's easier than doing that last 28 miles to get to the summit of Mitchell. You've still got elevation gain. I can't remember exactly how much, but it's a tough ride as well. It just doesn't have that last 28 miles of the more upward climb. But they really just kind of created that ride to open up the event to more people. And at one point, they did have Marion as a qualifier for Mitchell. So you had to have participated in Marion before you could actually register for Mitchell.
I see. It is no longer required?
It is no longer required, okay. No.
So the question that people ask me, and I know people who would love to do the Assault on Mount Mitchell, and they say, but we want to ride down. Explain why they cannot descend the mountain once they've climbed it. What is it that keeps you from letting riders go down?
It really, truly just becomes a safety standpoint and a logistical kind of tracking. There's people that are going to finish this ride, and that your fastest of your fast are going to finish this, you know, in 6 to 7 hours. But you've got some people that are not going to finish this ride until the cutoff time, right at 5:30. And for some people later in the day that are just doing everything they can to finish, I think if we were to look at them and say, great, refuel, now head back down. And while it would be, you know, going back down and you would be going downhill, there's still going to be elevation gain at different points. I just think from an endurance standpoint, we couldn't ask people to do that. It would take the ride way too late into the evening. I don't think we'd be able to track people appropriately and keep our eyes on them. And some of those roads leading up to the summit are pretty curvy and dangerous. And as you're approaching nightfall and just having, you know, people just being tired from the ride, from getting up there, it's just not something that we've ever really entertained.
So it never came up that maybe somebody who made the ascent in 4 hours could come back down? You just decided that was it, period.
It would be too hard to track. Okay. I think we've got so many cars on the course anyway, tracking people as they're coming up. I just think it would be too hard to try and keep eyes on everyone for a longer extended period of time.
So do you have rider limits? So how many people can sign up for Mount Mitchell and for Marion?
So Marion is unlimited. We can take as many as sign up. For Mitchell, we have had caps before. This year we are going to have a cap. We can take about 575 riders. The park itself is becoming more and more popular, which is great for Mount Mitchell. However, it's creating kind of a population control problem at the top with having tourists. They cannot close the park for our event. And so we take up so much space with the buses and the trucks and the riders and our tents and things of that nature that they've asked us to kind of step back the number of finishers that we have. And so we've done some numbers and we've realized that we can register probably around 575, and that's going to put us with a finishing number where they want us to be.
So does it help that you hold it on a Monday?
It does. And the whole reason, so the event used to be on a Saturday, and the park in the parkway came to us and they asked if we could please move our ride to a Monday, for the simple fact that the weekends were just so, so busy with tourism. It was just becoming a little bit hazardous between the cyclist and the tourist. So, and it definitely helps having it on a Monday, but I think it speaks volumes that even on Mondays now, the park service is becoming, you know, just a popular destination with people wanting to be outside.
Right, right. Well, it sounds like an amazing ride. It's just bizarre that it's 102 miles. It's all the way at this highest point, 6,500 feet. That's almost getting into the low Rockies numbers, you know?
It is. It is. I think it's over almost 10,000 feet of elevation gain from Spartanburg all the way
over
to
the 102. Nice.
Yeah.
So tell my listeners how they can find out more and when the 2019 event will take place.
Sure. We're super excited for this 44th year. It's going to be May 20th of 2019. So Monday, May 20th of 2019. The best way to find out more would be to visit www.theassaults.com. And you can also follow us on Facebook. If you follow us on Facebook, it's the Assault on Mount Mitchell and Marion. Shoot us a message, give us your email address, and we can add you to our, you know, our kind of bi-monthly e-blast that we send out to keep everyone to know. Registration is open right now.
I know something I forgot to ask you, and that's about spectators. So I know that you have all this congestion on the road. You have these trucks and you have the follow cars and everything else. What about people who obviously are coming along or want to see the event or watch these people struggle and sweat up this mountain? What do you do for spectators?
So we ask that all, you know, family and friends and anyone that just wants to kind of see what's going on, we ask them to come to Marion, North Carolina, to the rest stop number 5, which is the Tom Johnson campground, which is kind of our home base. It's where Net Control is, where all of our radio operators are. And we have spectator buses that are going to be running from Tom Johnson, and they'll take the spectators up to the mountain and they're going to drop them off. And we've got a specially designated spectator area at the top of the mountain for family and friends to watch their riders, you know, cross over the finish line. We do ask that, you know, people don't drive up to Mitchell if possible, because it just does, it adds to the congestion and it just creates, you know, more hazardous conditions for the riders.
Well, I know that it is one of those rides that wants to be on many, many cyclist bucket lists. I'm really glad we had a chance to talk. I've been speaking with Katie Jordan. She's one of the, if not the only, ride director for the Assaults, Mount Mitchell and Marion. It's May 20th, 2019. TheAssaults.com if you're interested in more information. I hope you have a wonderful day. How is the weather usually for that event?
The weather can, it varies. It can be, they can leave out of Spartanburg that morning, you know, at a nice 80 degrees. And by the time they get to the summit, you know, people are wearing sweaters and it's dropped down to 45 degrees. Yes. We've had snow before at Mitchell this late in the season. And there's always some sort of thunderstorm or rainstorm on the parkway typically. So you get a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you get a little bit of everything. Well, Katie, thank you so much for talking with me today. We will keep our eye on the Assaults. We'll add it to our Facebook page as a link. And I wish you a lot of luck with the event for 2019.
Thank you so much. I appreciated talking with you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you are interested in the Assaults, registration is already open, and you can find out more at theassaults.com. So let's take a short break, and I'll be back with a couple of news items before we talk with retired pro turned tour entrepreneur Marty Jemison. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Okay, then, just a couple of interesting items before we jet off to Park City to talk with Marty Jemison. First is the long-awaited memoir from Peter Sagan. It's titled My World. Besides being a 2-time world champion, Peter has to be one of the most colorful, interesting, and fun riders on the racing circuit today. My copy of the book is on its way from Velo Press, and I've contacted Peter to see if there is even a teeny-weeny chance he'd talk with me. I'm certainly not holding my breath, but we will review the book in an upcoming show. Now that Thanksgiving is over, and with more holidays that could lead us to temptations in food and slothfulness, I'd like to offer up a few comments from our friend Dr. Gabe Merkin. The November 23rd edition of his newsletter gives us some information about how to prevent dementia. Gabe says, "It now appears that you may help to delay and perhaps prevent Alzheimer's disease and any other forms of dementia if you exercise regularly, engage in lots of activities that require thinking, memory, and calculation, eat a plant-based Mediterranean-style diet, avoid alcohol, tobacco, and recreational drugs, avoid being overweight, and control high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and high blood sugar and other heart attack risk factors. If you are interested in seeing the reasons behind the recommendations and also to get on his mailing list, you can log on to drmerkin.com. Gabe and his wife Diana are well into their 80s now and healthy, and I want to be like them. So on that note, let's head out to Park City, Utah, and talk with Marty Jemison about Jemison cycling tours and more. Hey, Marty, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining me. We finally get to find some time to talk to one another.
Yeah, it's good to be here, Diane.
Yeah, well, you've been all over Europe all summer, all fall, and now you're home, so we'll be able to catch up. I've been really meaning to talk with you and learn more about what you do and where you came from. Let's go all the way back. Who's Marty and what is his relationship to cycling?
That's a good question. I was born and raised in Utah. I like to say now that I'm from Utah, but not of Utah. So I kind of grew up in Utah as maybe a black sheep within the herd, and maybe fought throughout my adolescence to leave the state, which took I guess maybe up and through college before I was truly outside of the state. But it's home now. When I finish either my racing season during the 90s or all through the 2000s up till now, I still come back in the winter and call Utah and more specifically Park City, Utah, my home.
Let's talk a little bit before we talk about the tours, because the tours are I've been following you all summer and following all these magnificent photographs and these posts that you're doing. But tell me a little bit about your racing career, because you have had a pretty illustrious career.
Thank you. I really do appreciate that. And I will say, I am very proud of myself and my accomplishments with cycling. I started out with just an absolute love of the bike itself. It as a vehicle that took me from point A to point B. And then that segued into finding racing, getting involved with racing voraciously. I was obsessed. Obsessed with a good balance the rest of my life as well. But when it came to the bike, I was very focused. I started racing in college, but I waited until I finished college and I went straight to Europe. And in Europe, I raced for 3 years on very small French amateur teams. And that's where I really, that was, I would say, my apprenticeship to racing. Because very, very different than the United States. As an amateur in France, I was racing upwards of 100 days per year, where every single race was, 80 or 100 miles plus. So there was nothing less than like 80 miles. There was no such thing as a crit. So I was racing nearly 3 days per week, circuit races or long road races, all the way back from, that was 1990.
Wow, that's a long time ago now. That's a long time ago.
You could keep making comments and then you'll know that I'm not a young kid.
I'm just doing the math.
What's that?
I said I'm doing the math.
don't spend too much time on the math.
Okay, well, yeah, if I do that, I'm looking at a hugely long career in the bicycle industry, so we'll just forget about that. So tell me a little bit about what your specialty was as a bike racer. Were you just like general racing, or did you really sort of gravitate toward one thing or another?
I was a good, so this is before I turned professional. I was a very good all around racer. So as an amateur, I won stage races, which means you need to be fairly balanced in all disciplines to be able to win stage races. I certainly was never the fastest time trialist. I was never the fastest sprinter. I was never the best climber as an amateur, but I was pretty well balanced. And if I was on my A game, I was able to win stage races. And then I also, my last year on a French team, I was in the top 10, 52 days out of almost 100 days of racing. And I won 11 races in that same year. So, that's classic. Most of it's classic European road racing with some wins or places in stage races.
Sounds pretty spectacular to me.
Well, thank you. There's good and bad with that, because, yes, I was able to win amateur stage races and individual one-day races when I was absolutely on fire. It's hard to have aspirations or to be, you know, at the professional level, it was more difficult. So it was harder to win races. After a while, it became known that I was just more of a rider that could be relied on from races starting in February all the way through October and race again, you know, 90 plus days a year and be there for the team more in a domestique role, with, you know, some aspirations and some personal, results along the way, but mostly focusing on and working for others.
Well, I think that's very, there's a word that is escaping me in the moment, but we'll come up with it eventually, but I think it's really cool. How's cool? Cool will do for now. So, okay. One of the things that interests me is how a rider like you, who spent so much time in Europe, transitioned from bike racing to doing what you're doing, which is really kind of high-end bicycle vacations, you might call them, or adventures for other people.
Yeah, that's exactly the way I would describe what I do. And unlike your question, for me it was very, very simple. The transition was easy for me. I don't know. I because of all my time traveling and racing throughout Europe for over a decade, I was very familiar with different regions, different cities, and sometimes hotels, and then sometimes routes. So I could use a lot of that information to build my cycling touring company. I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm maybe one of the only Americans or very few professional riders who, you know, finished college before I actually, you know, spent all those days, years racing the bike, just kind of put it all together. So, but it wasn't easy, but it wasn't so difficult either.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Marty Jemison. I hope I said that correctly.
Yes, you did.
Okay. He's in Park City, Utah, but that's not where he spends a lot of his time. He spends a lot of his time in Europe. I know you finished college. You have a degree in economics, I think. And
yes.
You are bilingual. So don't tell me English is your second language. What's your second language?
I would say my second language is French. And it's not pretty, but yes, I can communicate and understand French. And I can get by in 2 to 3 other Romantic languages with basic needs as I travel throughout Europe. And I say basic. Others would jump on me and say that's way too modest of a comment and that I can speak better than I admit. But I still like to err on being modest and saying that I can get by in multiple languages.
Fortunately, the Romance languages are similar enough in some ways that once you sort of master one, you can sort of poke your way through another one. So tell us a little bit about Jemison Cycling Tours, because I don't think they're what we think of, like Back Roads or Experience Plus or any of those types of tours. They're a little bit different.
That's a harder question for me to answer. It's hard for me to answer, but I think the first thought that comes to mind is those are good companies. And I think maybe the difference is, you know, with my trips, now I've done over 150 tours with my company, and I've been on 90% of those where I've been leading the rides or sharing leadership role with another guide. On 90% of those trips every single day. So there's my resume, but I think the other thing, some of the other companies, you know, they may have good employees, but I think I make sure that I bring people to the table, people that work for me. They bring something that's very credible within the cycling world and even closer to like the professional cycling world.
Okay. So then tell us a little bit about your tours themselves, because that seems to tell me that maybe you're also expecting a little more experienced rider.
You know, that's the myth, and no, absolutely not.
Oh,
no.
Okay then.
Honestly, I think, and I'd like to say something about that, because I think it could scare some people away, but no. I'm done being competitive. If I need to, I can, you know, turn on the engine and do what I need to do for certain clients. But really, we're a cycling vacation tour where we're going from point A to point B. And I like to have a smooth group ride where we're all kind of flowing together, kind of like a slinky that might stretch out and then come back to a slinky that might get stretched out, but then it comes back together where we're all kind of line of sight, but where it's all of my guests are riding well within their comfort level, you know, I will stop the group periodically so that everyone comes back together. And after we've done that for a day or two, I think they come to a relaxation. They're relaxed, and then they just understand what we're doing, and it just becomes a true cycling vacation tour for everybody.
What's the average length of your tours? Do they vary a lot, or are you within a fairly small range in terms of number of days?
I like 7 days of riding, mm-hmm. and 8 day trips. So
nice.
or 6 days of riding and 7 days trip. And we currently average just under 80 kilometers per day, which is just under 50 miles per day.
Perfect.
So it's not, I think we're just, you know, if we were on a ski mountain, you know, if people are familiar with green runs, blue runs and black runs, I think we're right in the middle. We're middle distance, middle difficulty, kind of blue, double blue kind of company.
What are some of the more popular tours that you're offering? What are the ones that people seem to gravitate to? And I know that people find a tour company and they often will take more than one tour. They'll come back and try another and another and another. But what are your most popular tours, and why would they be a little bit different from somebody else's, perhaps?
I think the most popular tour continues to be Girona, Spain, which is where I'm based. So we've been doing tours out of there since 2003. So we tend to do, you know, one, two or three trips per year out of Girona, Spain. I call it my signature tour, and we stick with that. Other trips right now, I mean, one that comes to mind that's kind of new and fresh on my mind is Puglia, Italy, the very, very bottom heel of the boot of Italy.
Right.
And that's just kind of a new trip that we've been doing the last few years that I'm really kind of passionate about right now. But there's a lot of trips in between the French Alps, the French Pyrenees mountains. We do more wine focused or food focused tours in Burgundy, Bordeaux. Provence is kind of a balance between food and wine. And then we circumnavigate Mont Ventoux, which is one of the largest climbs in Europe, which many people are familiar with. I'm spending less time in Tuscany, although we've done trips in Tuscany. And I mentioned, I'll go back to saying Puglia, because Puglia is more of an unknown area in southern Italy, which I'm just, you know, it's been a fun discovery. So kind of focusing on that. And then, like you mentioned, I do have a lot of repeat business, and I have customers who just choose areas that they want to go to. And then I create trips. I spend a lot of time creating trips for those folks. So I've been in wine regions in Champagne this year. A couple of years ago, we spent time in the Rioja region, Rioja, Spain. But then I'm trying to think of the Ribeira do Duero in Portugal. So more wine and the river that goes through there. The list goes on.
So you're willing to do a custom tour?
I do. More than half of what I do is custom tours.
Wow.
So like friends or families who, you know, they ask, like, well, you know, I did a trip this year for a father and a daughter, and I worked that trip myself. We do groups of guys. I've done women's only groups. We're doing more of that.
I love that.
Thank you.
Well, I just think that, you know, everybody offers XYZ, but if you come up with an idea and bring it to you and you're just willing to say, yeah, I'll do that, that's pretty cool. How about bikes? Are you renting bikes to people, or are people bringing their own bikes on tour?
We do both. So okay. I've gone through different, more than, we've turned over a fleet of bikes two or three times with different types of bikes. And then we've had years where, you know, majority of people, like years ago, I would say the majority of people, like over 90% of people brought their own bikes. And I think that went to a point where it changed, where there might be 90% of the people were renting bikes. And then I'd say, you know, recently it's been kind of a balance. So we'll have some people bringing their own bikes and some people that want us to source bikes for them, either renting the bikes we have. And sometimes I'll source other bikes if they have needs that are specific that we might be able to provide.
Are people asking for any pedal assist e-bike type stuff?
Yes.
That's a great answer. I love it. One word. Yes.
You know what? I'm a big fan.
Me too.
So I have some gentlemen. It's a private trip. They're a private group of guys that they only see each other like once a year, and they come and do a cycling trip once a year. And they've been with me for over 10 years. And they started out when they were in their late 50s and early 60s. And now they're in their late 60s and early 70s. And three this year, have used e-assist bikes. And it's been a lot of fun, and I'm a big fan.
So do you think that's opening the possibility for another whole group of people who may not have thought about cycling as a great vacation?
Yes, absolutely. I think I'm happy that my clients who use e-assist were true cyclists throughout their adulthood before they needed the e-bike.
Sure.
I don't think I would have much fun with just a person who was not bike savvy, who had not grown up or spent time riding a regular bike through cities, traffic, or knowing all the rules, with just jumping on an e-bike. I don't think I'd feel comfortable with that. So I am happy that my guests are those that were true cyclists that now just need a little bit of help. And I'll mention one of those clients, it wasn't so much his age or anything, but, he had burst an Achilles tendon.
The worst.
Yeah, like 6 months before the trip. So he's not one that was ready, quite ready for an e-bike, but it enabled him to be with his friends and do the trip and then just not have to push so many watts to be a part of the group.
Yeah. Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Marty Jemison. We're talking about his company, Jemison Cycling Tours, and some of the differences. And I like the idea. You just said something that just kind of struck a chord with me. Number one, people being together on a ride like this or on an event, a tour like this, and who could keep up with one another and who didn't feel self-conscious about the needs that they may or may not have that would be different as they grew older. Growing older myself, not getting any younger myself. I think it's really, really interesting. How about what you do in the winter? What are you doing now? Are you working on 2019 tours?
Yes, I'm working on 2019 tours. And then here in the office, we've got to make updates to the website, which is always, I always feel like it's it doesn't get the attention that it needs, but we need to update it where it has at least pertinent information of dates and trips that are offered, et cetera, et cetera. And then, so that's marketing, advertising, and then preparation for trips next year and just making sure that things fit in the calendar. So we spend most of the winter doing those things. And then I balance out office work with, staying outside and staying as healthy and active as I can while I'm still very much involved in running the business.
Yeah, I know. That's hard because then you start seeing yourself at a desk all the time. So who puts all those pictures up that I see on Facebook? Do you do that yourself?
Most of that is myself, yes. Most of the Facebook stuff is me.
They're nice.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I remember the other question I wanted to ask you, and it was about the equipment that you'll put on the bike or you'll let people bring to put on their bike. How many people are asking for things like responses to watts and cadence and heart rate? Are people actually asking for those kinds of accessories to go on one of these trips? Or are they saying, no, this is a vacation?
Well, I don't know what they're thinking, but I would shy away from any of that. So I'm not going to provide any. If they have their own personal bike, that's up to them.
Okay.
But, I really am focused on cycling vacation tours. And, we're doing nearly 50 miles a day. So we're riding our bikes.
Right.
But all the things you just mentioned, watts or gizmos or power or these kinds of things, that is not what we're doing. Yeah. So I like to, that's just too much to think on. I would like people to actually, we're riding our bikes, so that's very, very, it's important to me, but then also to be able to look left and right and actually appreciate the cultures and the places where we are and enjoy the people and the food, et cetera, et cetera.
Let me ask you something about some of your tour guides, because you seem to have some really interesting people who work with you. Are they all bilingual or multilingual?
I'm going to say most of them have been. And in recent years, I've been focusing on independent contractors, people that I may create relationships with are European or live in Europe. There's been a few expats that have spent years living in Europe where I've brought them on board. I do want people that bring something very strong to the table that I feel is an asset to the business that I'm running. So maybe other companies are hiring, summer jobs for college students or something, but I want something much more than that. I want, the people that work for me to have a strength that deems them a professional at some level in some aspect that you may find around a professional cycling team, whether it's a massage therapist, maybe you were a professional athlete or an aspiring professional athlete, or maybe you're the wife of a professional cyclist. I mean, I've had all kinds of people that might be like inside the door of professional cycling, but it's just because I want to be able to share that with people who want to learn from the best.
I like that a lot. Should we talk about food? I'm sure food is just, it's way important to cyclists usually.
I'm very careful with choosing accommodations that have a full breakfast in the morning. That's important. I don't have any input on what people may be eating. That's up to them. Well, we balance the week out with cuisine in, you know, nicer restaurants, but it's up to our guests to choose what they want to eat. So does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I assume some food is included.
Yes, it is.
But they can just pick off the menu is what you're saying.
Exactly.
I get it. So it's not like they're going to just family style throw stuff on the table and this is what you're getting tonight. I got it.
Correct.
No, I like Correct. That too, because, you know, everybody's eating differently now. You know, some people want vegetarian, some people want vegan, some people want a real omnivore meal. You know, I understand that. I totally get it.
That's right.
Do you have any new trips that you're planning for 2019?
Currently, no. I have about 20 plus regions or 20 plus areas where I've done trips repeatedly. So maybe out of that 20, there's, you know, one, two or three that I've only done maybe twice. But so those are all possibilities. The calendar is still in the works for what we'll offer, you know, on the website. But we're not, I mean, anything is possible. So if I get two, three or four people that want to do a trip, they could choose from any one of those 20 products.
Are you already booking tours for 2019? Have people already contacted you and said, I want to do this then?
Yes, because some people who have been on my trips in the past, they know that if they want a spot on the calendar, that they need to act fast. Mm-hmm. So there have been a couple of trips arranged already.
Okay, so now we're gonna leave Europe for a minute and ask Marty some questions. What do you do when you're not working on your business and you're not conducting tours? What are you doing in Park City?
Aside from keeping the business going, I spend time on my bike, whether I focus more on my mountain bike, my fat bike, and a little bit of the road bike, very, very little indoor bike, but I'll do that occasionally. And then I also, depending on snow conditions or et cetera, I do spend a lot of time skate skiing. And then also I'm working for Deer Valley Mountain Resort, and I will guide 1 to 2 days per week on the ski mountain. So that's where you can find me once or twice a week and just downhill skiing.
All right. So, you know, I ask my fun guests 3 questions. What's your favorite food?
My favorite food? Wow. You know what? I think I have a vast palate and a vast appreciation for many types of food. And I'm going to back it up with some evidence. And that is that I was one of the riders on the team when we traveled around the world, and more so when I was on the national team or as an amateur, when we were traveling more throughout, you know, the entire globe. And I was excited to go to any table in any country and eat just about any food. I might not like everything that was offered, but I was always able to find food I liked. And there was very little that I didn't care for. So my palate is quite wide. And so I can be happy eating many different things.
All right. That was a good answer. A little vague, but it was good. I'll take it. All right. How about this? Can you hone in on music you like?
Ooh, I'm going to be more vague. How's that?
Oh, great.
I do. I love music. I really do. I'm going to say it's sadly, I was so focused in my cycling career that music was kind of on the back burner. And then running this business and being so involved in this business, music has been kind of on the back burner. But there are moments when, you know, when I'm around music or occasionally I put on music, and it's still very important to me. It's just kind of been on the back burner, but I love all kinds of all genres. And I mean, I could tell stories where I've just walked into certain places. Maybe it was my time off in little places around Europe, whether there was music on, you know, being played over the speaker system or live music. And again, you know, a spread of genre, and I truly appreciate it. And really it's almost the same as in sports. When you come across someone who's truly good and truly passionate about their craft, I think I recognize that, and I really appreciate it and enjoy it.
Such interesting answers, Marty. Not normal, but interesting. All right. So I pretty much know the answer to this because I know you spend a lot of time out of the country, but do you have any pets?
Currently, no. But the last pet that we had was a cat. And I will say that we traveled. There was three different years that we brought the cat to Europe.
So, really?
Yeah, and I had a particular bond with the cat because I was the one who had to take the cat out of its carrying case and hold the cat and walk through the metal detectors. And, you know, the cat was fearful for its life and had a special bond with the cat. So I know what it's like to bring a pet to and from Europe.
Yeah, I'll bet. Well, the last thing we need to do is let listeners know how to find out more about Jemison Cycling Tours. And then I'm going to let you get back to doing what you were doing.
Okay. The way you can get a hold of me is through the website, jemisoncycling.com. My last name is spelled J-E-M-I-S-O-N, cycling, C-Y-C-L-I-N-G.com. Or you can call me, text me, message me, 801-971-5572. That's my business phone that also gets sent straight to my cell phone on most occasions. So I really like people to try and get to me as soon as possible to answer more questions because the website has limitations and I think our business is a little more personal. So I like people to get to me as soon as they can.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. I hope you have a wonderful holiday coming up and I'll be watching the Facebook page. Maybe someday we'll get over to Europe and be able to join you on one of your tours. I would really like that.
All right. Thank you, Diane. It's been a pleasure.
All right. You take care.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye. Marty Jemison joined me from his winter home in Park City, Utah. As he said, his work is really headquartered in Girona, Spain. If you're thinking about a Jemison cycling tour, you can log on to jemisoncyclingtours.com. So that's our show for this week. Thanks to all my guests, Kristen Wentworth from Planet Bike, Katie Jordan from the assaults on Mount Mitchell and Marion, and Marty Jemison. You can join the ongoing conversation on our Facebook page. Send us a tweet at Outspoken without an E, or leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of The Outspoken Cyclist, including a chat with Luke Humphreys, the CEO of Pacenti Cycle Design, and a talk with Simon Firth from Transport Cycles in Philadelphia. Thank you for listening. Stay safe out there. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.